Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Creighton Sebra with Clark Hill, and I represent the appellants, Jeffrey and Kathleen Ludlow. And in this matter, the court should reverse the summary judgment from the district court because the loss of use damages were a natural and foreseeable consequence of the water damage that was caused to the appellant's home, because these loss of use damages were not only both foreseeable, but they were not a special circumstance. In addition, the court should reverse the district court's finding regarding the duty of care by Lowe's because the tort duties went beyond the contractual duties to deliver the refrigerator and to hook up the water line, which is evidenced by the representations that were made by Lowe's to the Ludlows prior to and at the time of forming the contract, as well as the Lowe's delivery manual sets forth its own independent duties that they would adhere to, which will also transcend the contract.
Well, counsel, assuming there were to be consequential damages, I'm troubled by the problem of competent evidence to support your claim. What specific admissible competent evidence is there in this record?
Are you referring to the loss of use, Your Honor?
Yeah. Well, or any of the other claims that you're making on the theory of consequential damages.
Yes, Your Honor. The loss of use is supported by, first, obviously, the lower court did strike some of the experts. Mr. Ferguson would be an expert that would talk about the diminution of value. That testimony was not allowed. Secondly.
But are you appealing that, or are you just going to?
Yes, Your Honor. That's part of the appeal.
All right.
They're also.
Well, that's more than loss of use. In addition to loss of use, there's a claim for a purported reduction in value of the property.
There's two components.
But all of that is supported by Mr. Ferguson, and Mr. Ferguson's been struck. So I think Judge O'Scanlan's question really gets at it. What competent proof was there for any of these claims?
If we think the district court didn't err in striking Mr. Ferguson and I guess Mr. Boone's testimony, was there enough other evidence in the record?
Yes, Your Honor, that's I was getting to is that Mr. Boone's testimony was admitted in part and struck in part, and then there was three paragraphs that were struck that did deal with loss of use and how long that would take to do. There's also evidence that was admitted by.
So if that struck, so my question was, if we agree with the district court in its determination in its evidentiary rulings, is there adequate evidence to support your claim?
Yes, Your Honor, there is evidence, and that comes from Mr. Durnian, who was the defendant's own adjuster. He made an independent evaluation that there would be loss of use. He set that as an approximate 30 days. He didn't testify as an expert, but he did testify in his deposition that he felt that there would be a period of time.
Well, if he's not an expert, what's his statement worth?
Well, he's obviously there. He evaluated the property.
I'm here. That doesn't mean I'm in a position to offer competent testimony. Telling me that he's there really doesn't tell me why it was the court should pay any attention to what he had to say on the subject.
But he does testify that there would be a period of time that during the repairs that there would be a loss of use. He goes in.
But that doesn't answer the question why the court should care what he says. You tell me what he says, what makes him competent to say that? You've just told us he wasn't qualified as an expert. So why does anybody pay attention to what he has to say?
Well, I think in this case, whether there's loss of use is a reasonable, foreseeable outcome of when you have damage to the property.
You're shifting to a different question. We are trying to focus, assume for the moment that we agree with you that this loss of use claim was reasonably foreseeable. I look at the record, I don't see where it was proven up. And so the question to you is, where was it proven up? What's the evidence? And so far, you've told me about an expert who's not an expert. Still don't have any evidence that proves up that claim with the reasonable certainty required by Hawaii law.
The Ludlows testified that they would not be able to use the property themselves. Mr. Durnian's testimony.
For how long?
Based on Mr. Boone's testimony, that he estimated that his repairs would take approximately about 50 days. And so that testimony is there. Mr. Boone went through how long he would take to do those repairs. And so when you combine Mr. Durnian's testimony saying, look, the property's not going to be livable, you don't have the kitchen, you don't have the first floor, it's not reasonable.
How much of the year does your client occupy the property?
The testimony on the record is that this is their primary residence. I'm sure it varies from year to year, but they do consider Maui to be their residence. In fact, this morning, my client was...
As to how much time, Judge Clifton's question was how much time. Is there evidence in the record as to how much time they spend there?
I don't think it's clear as to by year to year, but they do hold that out to be their primary residence. And I think
I have a primary residence also located in Hawaii as it happens, but that doesn't mean I'm there 100% of the time. And so if work gets scheduled, it often gets scheduled when I'm not there. And so I haven't heard any answer to the question that tells me why the time for repair can't be taken care of when your client's otherwise not going to be there. And then telling me that it's our primary residence, I mean, that may be the evidence that's in the record, but that doesn't answer the question that I'm trying to get an answer to.
And it is, the record does show that they're not on Maui 100% of the time. So that is true. But Hawaii law does not require the person to be there 100% of the time. And that's not the same.
No, but it doesn't tell me why work that might need them to vacate the property for a fairly limited period can't be scheduled when they're not going to be there.
Well, they are not off island for months at a time. Maybe a week or two there.
And also,
Mr. Ludlow did testify to that, Your Honor.
His testimony.
Yes. And also, if they're not on island, they have to turn that property over to someone else.
I got to tell you, I come into this claim having seen it first really as a rental claim, which gets knocked out because Maui law doesn't permit rentals. And so it seems like the theory has somehow shifted, but the proof for the shifting theory really is kind of tenuous. And so these questions are sincere, but I have trouble seeing how the claim, even if legally viable, has been proven.
Well, obviously the district court gutted the ability for us to bring in evidence and to prove the loss of use. And so at that point in time...
So if we need to get to those witnesses, maybe you better tell us why those witnesses provided testimony that should be admitted.
Mr. Ferguson's testimony goes to the diminution of value of the property as we went through.
Is he an appraiser?
He is a real estate broker.
I think the answer to my question is not whether he's a real estate broker, but is he a real estate appraiser?
No, he doesn't hold the license for appraisal. But he has been, on Maui for over two
decades. Did he cite any particular examples of homes that suffered this kind of damage and to provide the basis for some opinion?
Yes, Your Honor. He did cite, I believe, three are in the record that he was able to find that would have diminution of value.
But he didn't relate it to the water damage. It was very vague, and he wasn't involved in those sales. He was just making estimates. It seemed quite vague what he was saying.
It's based upon the Hawaii law that you have to disclose a material fact, and both not.
Well, and I didn't understand that either. I mean, if the water damage is all repaired, because they're the proposal, and I guess the district court found that the Ludlows were entitled to have the whole floor removed and replaced, even though only a portion of it was damaged. Once it's repaired, I don't understand why there would be any diminution value for water damage.
In other states and other jurisdictions, that you don't have to disclose if you've repaired a particular
right. issue. Well, even if you disclose, why is there any diminution in value if it's completely repaired? You say, we have a brand new floor in here that enhances the value,
yes,
right?
Yeah, I appreciate that, Your Honor. And that issue was raised, and Mr. Ferguson did discuss that. And because it's a material fact, it does have to be disclosed over time. And not only did Mr. Ferguson confirm that, but also defendant's expert, Mr. Yaramamura, confirmed that water damage would, in fact, be a material fact that would have to be disclosed that would have diminution of value.
Could I get back to the question of in contract damages on the contract claim? The cases indicate that it has to be within the contemplation of the parties at the time the contract was entered into. And I think the district court was concerned that even though there might be some damage with respect to installing a refrigerator, it was skeptical that it was in the contemplation of the parties that the house would have to be shut down for a month and there would be a cost for replacement housing and relocation expenses and acclimatization of the wood flooring. So why was the district court wrong on that?
The district court was wrong because it placed its emphasis on that it was a special circumstance, and the district court focused only on the actual damages, not actually on what the parties were contemplating at the time of the contract. And the court, the Virginia...
What's the evidence of the contemplation of the parties that the installation of the refrigerator could lead to these sorts of replacement housing and relocation expenses?
Well, the district court held that the receipt was the contract, and that's Exhibit 32, and said that the confines of the contract are based on that. However, with respect to whether it's foreseeable, there's a two-pronged test. Whether it's foreseeable, and the parties don't have to have every single measure of damage at the time of the contract. The cases are clear that a defendant doesn't have to have a tacit agreement for it to be foreseeable. The breaching parties' own education, training, and experience also factors into play here. And certainly with respect to with Lowe's being a sophisticated party corporation, they know that when you're going to, if you damage a person's property, that you're going to have potential water damage, which can lead certainly to loss of use. So it's foreseeable in that respect. The court also really hinged its hat on the special circumstances exception, which we've obviously noted in our briefing, doesn't apply here because the special circumstances they felt weren't the actual products of the home or how the home itself was actually the damage is that it was loss of use. And so the district court unfairly placed that burden on the Ludlows to disclose any of those potential things that would happen. At the time that they're purchasing the refrigerator, it's really unfair for that burden to be placed on the defendants to say, hey, by the way, if you damage my property, these damages are going to be foreseeable and that you're going to have to replace those things. They're expecting Lowe's to maintain their agreement and to
do that properly. Do you think it's natural and probable that it would be within the contemplation of ordinary parties that the installation of refrigerator would require the replacement of the entire flooring and shut down the house for 50 days? Is that?
Yes.
I mean, the district court was very skeptical. I sort of share that. That seems very unlikely for installation of a refrigerator.
Well, it's not just the refrigerator. They're also connected to a water line. When you're dealing with water...
Most refrigerators are.
Right, exactly. So when you're dealing with water, you always have the possibility that you will have damage and that, water obviously damages, products. And the test is more of an objective test, Your Honor. And Lowe's delivery manual, which is not a part of the contract, was particularly instructive on this. And it says in Exhibit 33, they put to their own employees that every precaution must be taken to protect against the customer's property. Special care must be taken on all surfaces, and they must carry all the necessary tools to effectuate the delivery. So they knew the risks. Lowe's own experience, they knew these risks. And so it wasn't a special circumstance. I do want to reserve some of my time. I have 2 minutes, and I will, if there aren't any other questions, I'll wait for a rebuttal.
Good morning, members of the court. My name is Edmund Safari, and I, along with my colleague Linda Arakawa, who is seated at council table, represent Lowe's Home Centers, LLC, in this matter. Now, as the court, I think, has caught on to, this is really a simple property damage case in which there was flooring damage sustained to a residence during the delivery of a refrigerator. That's what it's about. Now, importantly, the plaintiffs have been awarded damages for the actual cost of repairing the actual damage to the property. So why are we here? We're here because the plaintiffs sought to turn a simple property damage claim into a windfall by seeking hundreds of thousands of dollars in loss of use damages to the tune of $3,000 a day and speculative damages of 10% of their property's value when or if they sold their house at some point in the future. Now, our position, as stated in the briefs, is that this court should affirm the trial court's judgment because plaintiffs' exorbitant demands for loss of use and loss of value are not supported by Hawaii law and not supported by competent evidence. Fundamentally, while plaintiffs urge the court to engage in an analysis of purely state law issues related to what Hawaii law requires as to the recovery of consequential damages, and when or if a claimant can sue in tort for the very same conduct he claims constitutes a breach of contract, the fact remains that this court does not need to reach those state law issues in order to conclude that the judgment in this matter should be affirmed. The reason for this is very simple. This case, as the court has focused on and latched onto, is that it really turns on two evidentiary issues, which the court below ruled on. The first was that the claim for loss of use damages, which is ultimately based on expert testimony from a construction professional, Matt Boone, that testimony was specifically excluded for the simple reason that the plaintiff chose not to disclose that testimony as they were required to under Rule 26 in a timely manner. Now, what is critically important to that point is that the plaintiffs have not appealed that ruling here. So that ruling is not before the court. So what happens here, so the real issue here is whether or not Matt Boone, the flooring expert, and his testimony were properly excluded as expert testimony. Now, the plaintiff has taken the position that, well, the specific provisions of the declarations that were submitted by Mr. Boone at the trial, paragraphs 11 through 14, somehow, that's all lay testimony, because he testified as to acclimation of the floor and how long, what kind of construction would need to be done, and which would then lead to the question of how long the loss of use would be. I consider myself a relatively intelligent person, but it is not in my common experience, nor in the common experience of most people I know, unless they actually work in the industry, as to how long a floor needs to acclimate before it actually can be installed, or how long construction has to go on in order to remove a wooden floor of this nature and what needs to be done. So that assessment by the court, striking the testimony, is judged by an abuse of discretion standard, and there was no abuse of discretion here. The second ruling, which is critical to the entire case, is the question of the exclusion of Mr. Ferguson. Now, what is the evidence as to Mr. Ferguson? What is interesting about this case, and I would cite the court, we cited the decision of this court in the Ollier versus Sweetwater Union High School District, and that case basically said that in a case such as this, where you have a case being tried to a judge and not a jury, where the judge is essentially their own gatekeeper, there should be wide latitude granted to that judge regarding the admission of evidence. So what happened here was that you have the declaration of Mr. Ferguson, and prior to that, there was also his report. What's interesting about the fact that when the judge is acting as his own gatekeeper is the fact that in order to actually perform that function, he had to read the report. He read the declaration, and as part of that analysis, looked at it and said, this is simply not reliable, and decided to discard it. Now, the question here is whether or not that ruling, according to the Ollier case, was illogical or implausible. I would submit, Your Honors, that there is no such showing of that here. Once you remove the testimony of both Mr. Ferguson and the stricken testimony of Mr. Boone, who was an expert, the case stands on nothing. There is no evidence to support the claims for loss of use. There is no evidence to support the claim for diminution in value, which on its face, I would also argue, is purely speculative.
So opposing counsel points to testimony from an adjuster, Darian, and also the Ludlow's own testimony.
Mm-hmm. And first of all, neither of that testimony was expert testimony. Mr. Ludlow is not a home builder, so he could not testify to that, whatever he was testifying to. And my recollection is his testimony was vague on that issue in any event. As to Mr. Darian, Mr. Darian, at trial, I cross-examined him, and he said he would defer to the experts on the matter as to whether or not there would be a loss of use. And my own expert testified that there was not provable in this case. So, and I, the portion of the record for Mr. Darian's testimony is 11 excerpts of records submitted by the plaintiff, 167, paragraph 9. So, ultimately, there really is no evidence, no competent evidence upon which the plaintiff's damages claims can be proven. And so the ultimate legal issues that they would rather the court focus on relating to the application of the Hadley versus Baxendale rule and how it has developed in Hawaii under the AmFat case and following other cases such as Bowe do not have to be reached by this court. In the end, it comes down to two key evidentiary rulings, which are subject to an abuse of discretion standard under the Ollier case. And plaintiff has not, by any stretch of the imagination, shown that those rulings were either an abuse of discretion or illogical, or just simply unsupportable. I am prepared to answer any of the questions the court may have.
Apparently,
I guess I'll have one question, which is this. I mean, Hawaii law is tough with regard to the requirement to make disclosure. And leaving aside for a moment the quality of the evidence offered up by plaintiffs with regard to the reduction in market value, the district court's order cited the failure of plaintiffs to have any intent to sell the property as a basis for precluding that. And I don't understand the logic behind that. I mean, I own a house here. I don't have any intent to sell. If something happens to it, the fact that I don't have an intent to sell doesn't mean that the future market value isn't diminished. So can you explain to me the basis for the district court's ruling to that effect?
To the extent that there is no proof as to when the property will be sold, the notion that there could be a 10% diminution in value of the property, putting aside that the methodology for arriving at that conclusion was completely suspect and unreliable, the fact remains that the district court's decision on that point was in accordance with Hawaii law, which says that damages have to be proven with reasonable certainty. Now, in this
case, does that mean I can't get loss of value if I don't intend to sell? I mean, suppose I wish I had a great sports car, and it gets somebody runs into it. I don't want to sell it, but it does impact the value of it, separate and apart from the repairs. Does that mean if I don't plan to sell, I forfeit the loss or forfeit the right to claim for the loss?
No, I would concede, Your Honor, that if that is the proposition, that would alone not would be questionable. The bottom line is, in this case, the evidence that was submitted, which was the 10% reduction, and there was no other evidence submitted on this issue as to what the loss of use, the diminution in value damages.
But did it turn on the intent to sell?
It did not, Your Honor.
Oh, okay.
I don't believe it did. It turned on the fact that the methodology that was being used by Mr. Ferguson was completely suspect. You know, and what I repeat again that what happened here was that the judge in this case, in deciding these issues were raised first on a motion in limine. And he decided at that point that he would give the plaintiffs a chance to prove up their case by presenting evidence that their expert was in fact qualified. And when they submitted their declarations on direct, which is the one opportunity to show that, to demonstrate that point, they failed to do so. And in making his ruling, Judge Chang also, in the transcript, you'll read that he went back over the report, and in concluding that report itself was unreliable, decided on that basis to strike the testimony. Now, I go back that the plaintiff's argument here has been, well, you know, there's a checklist. If he satisfies one of the items, then he should have been allowed to testify. Now, the thing about it is that in the Ollier case, Ollier makes clear that it is well settled in the Ninth Circuit that bare qualifications alone cannot establish the admissibility of expert testimony. Rather, we have interpreted Rule 702 to require that expert testimony be both relevant and reliable. The court specifically made a finding on the record that the methodology employed here by Mr. Ferguson was not, in fact, reliable. And that determination, based on a review, again, this is not a situation where we had a jury trial and the court acting as gatekeeper made sure the trier of fact never heard any of this. The judge in this case read the report. The judge in this case got to read the declaration, and after having done so, decided that it in fact was not reliable. That, under Ollier, should be accorded great deference. There are any other questions?
Apparently not. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Just a few points. First, with respect to the diminution of value, Mr. Ferguson was primarily disqualified because the court said he didn't have the qualifications. He felt he didn't have a degree or other things necessary to serve him to be qualified as an expert. That's the first point. And whether or not 10% is the measure of the diminution of value really goes to the weight, not whether the evidence should come in. And that could be considered based upon the court. Could make that analysis whether 10% was reasonable. I also want to point out Mr. Yamamura, the defendant's own expert, agreed that damages of water would, in fact, be a material fact that would have to be disclosed, and that if, in fact, that was a material fact, then there would be diminution of value. Mr. Yamamura didn't, of course, testify that because the defendants didn't want him to testify to that, but he did confirm that there would be diminution of value. And taking Mr. Ferguson out of the equation.
That doesn't solve the problem of what. I can understand the concept, but that's not evidence that's going to be sufficient to establish any amount as required by Hawaii law with reasonable certainty.
Mr. Ferguson would have explained why 10% is the measure, and the court could have taken that into consideration. It didn't. It took his qualifications solely into consideration.
We do have the judge as the trier of fact here. If he decides that this person isn't qualified, whether it's a legal decision in terms of qualification as an expert or whether it's a determination he's not very persuasive, isn't the end result the same?
No, he would have to hear the evidence, admit him, and then the evidence now would be on the record that we did have loss of use. And instead, he focused in on the qualifications. And I know my time is short, Your Honors. I'd like to just point out that under Hawaii law, the special circumstances is an objective, it's a reasonable test. And to place the burden on the Ludlows to disclose everything under the breach of contract standard is undue. And instead of taking the totality of circumstances and placing that burden equally upon the parties. Thank you.
Okay, we thank both parties for their argument, and the case of Ludlow v. Lowe's is submitted.